Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, August 21st, 2000. In the fireside room this morning, we have John DeGraff. Today's session is entitled, Using Television to Promote Social Change, The Courage of Their Convictions. Let's listen in.
Hi, welcome everyone. It's great to see such a big group here, especially on a morning like this when I'm sure everybody wants to be out walking and enjoying this terrific place. I'm John DeGraff, and by way of introduction, I just wanted to say that I've been a filmmaker for the last nearly a quarter of a century, making primarily documentaries and primarily for public television stations and for national public television. But I got involved in the documentary field really because I wanted to tell stories about people who had the courage of their convictions and who took stands and who worked hard to make our society and our world a better place. I'd seen an awful lot of documentaries, very well done, about the social and environmental problems and things that we all see around us and that we all face, but many of them, however well done, would end up simply leaving viewers feeling depressed at the end, and with a sense of, oh my God, you know, the world's falling apart, I might as well go have fun or do something else because it's all so big and so overwhelming. And so one of the things that I really felt was that people need role models and young people also need other kinds of heroes who are ordinary people that really do this sort of work, stand up for their beliefs and try to make our world a better place. And these people aren't superhuman in any sense. I mean, either the heroes that I think kids grow up with on television particularly are either, I mean, even if they're good guys, they're either superhuman, i.e. Superman, etc., or they're heroes who accomplish everything that they accomplish by violent force, usually within 30 minutes or less. And so, you know, they may be good guys or so forth, so to speak, but I don't think the way they go about to make the changes that they do or to fight evil is necessarily the kind of model that that we want. So I have looked, as I looked at various issues in the late 1970s and early 1980s that were important to me, that were going on at the time, I also looked for people who could inspire others and could be models that people could look at and say, hey, I could do that, I could be like that. And when I moved to Seattle in 1980, I was living in Minnesota at the time and got my start in public television with KTCA in St. Paul. And shortly after I moved to Seattle, the big thing that was kind of happening out in this part of the world was the imminent coming of the first Trident submarine to Puget Sound. And there were, at the time, many, many groups of people who were organizing demonstrations, who were very concerned about this massive nuclear-armed submarine and what the implications were of its being essentially only about 15 air miles from Seattle. Not only the fact that it made us ground zero and the target of a nuclear attack, but also that it was a destructive force that would if unleashed, could kill millions of people around the world. And I was looking for the story, the person who would help us, me both talk about the issues involved with the Trident submarine and the issues of war and peace and nuclear deterrence at the time, but also someone who would be inspirational to a general public. And it was true that many of the protesters, who were all wonderful people, were very counterculture, and I was pretty counterculture myself. But my feeling was that many of them would not necessarily, their voices might not be heard by the broad public watching television. and that I needed somebody who would at least seem to be more conservative, more regular, that could kind of break through, and found that person in an 80-year-old, very active Lutheran church woman whose name was Ruth Young Dahl Nelson. And some of you may have known her. She died in 1984, but she was a national U.S. Mother of the Year and a pillar in the Lutheran church community, as was her son, and is her son, John, who for many years was pastor, a Lutheran pastor in Seattle. So I produced a film called Mother of the Year about Ruth Young Dahl Nelson's journey to become, as an 80-year-old woman, to become an anti-nuclear protester. And I'm going to show you just the first few minutes of that. It's the oldest film, and it's the probably doesn't look quite as good as some of the others will, but it'll give you a sense of the theme that I have in mind. And then I'll also be showing very short clips from several other films about different kinds of activists and what they do. If someone can do me a favor and just do the lights. Bruce. Okay.
And the Washington Commission for the Humanities, state programs of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Oh, I never wanna be just a fool.
It always surprises people when I tell them that I'm an accused felon.
And then, as you might suspect, the story goes on to kind of give a sense of Ruth's upbringing and family life and her church activities, and establishes her as a traditional all-American mom and grandma, and then from that explores her journey as she learned more and more about the issues of nuclear war and what it could bring, and finally comes to go out there in a very tiny boat, a very dangerous situation, especially for a woman Ruth's age, out in Puget Sound, and it wasn't storming, but the waves were pretty high, and the water cannons and all the action was, you know, it was quite a thing. And she was arrested, eventually acquitted, but it's not a story of success in the sense that Ruth Youngdahl Nelson didn't stop the Trident submarine from coming in, but I think she really helped to alert people and make people really think about the issues that are involved and what this immense weaponry really could be. So this is the kind of thing that I try to do, is to in my work, and I see it as a calling, is to inspire people to use TV, which is clearly I'm sure most of us think the vast wasteland that it was once called years ago, and there are certainly lots of people who I have all my sympathy who simply don't own one, or throw one out, or get rid of one. But my feeling is most people aren't going to do that, and it is going to be a force whether we like it or not, and people are going to be watching, and hopefully they can be inspired from these kind of stories to turn off the tube and get out and do something. The second clip I want to show you is also about another Lutheran church woman. These films were done about a year apart, and this was purely by accident that I happened to end up telling two stories about two women, both from Minnesota, and both very actively involved in the Lutheran Church. But one of the issues that I had gotten involved in Minnesota when I lived there in the late 70s was some of the support work that was being done by people in the Twin Cities for small farmers who were facing many, many crises, both economic foreclosures and those kinds of problems, but also the pushing of a massive power line through central Minnesota. Actually, one of the leaders of the protests against that is now Senator Wellstone, one of Minnesota's two senators. But so I wanted to do a story about the farm struggles and what was happening in middle America to farmers. And we actually found three women, two of whom were dairy farmers and one who farmed wheat and soybeans, and that's the one that's Ann Canton, who this segment you will see is about. And many of you may know her as well. This particular film came out on public television in 1983, so it's also dated. We're kind of moving up the line a little bit here.
What was the year of the first one?
1982. Mm-hmm. And after this, by all means, interrupt me at any point if you have comments or questions.
Chuck Canton grow wheat, barley, soybeans, and sugar beets in western Minnesota. Three generations of Cantons have plowed this ground.
Good morning.
and Chuck know their land intimately and treat it with loving care. They hope their son Kent, the oldest of their three children, can keep farming here. The Cantons took the advice of experts who said expand for the coming boom in agriculture. They bought more land and bigger machines, but expansion was not the answer. They are hardworking, efficient, productive farmers, but they are going deeper into debt.
After farming on this farm for some over 20 years, Chuck and I looked at one another and realized, you know, there is something wrong. There is something wrong. Is it us? And are we just doing everything wrong on this place? Or what's happening to us in our small town and to some of our neighbors?
Seed, fuel, fertilizer, machinery, credit. The Cantons' costs have tripled in the past 10 years. They spend more than $6 to produce a bushel of wheat, but at harvest must sell it for less than $4. A few giant grain companies dominate the market. The only choice the Cantons have is to sell or wait, hoping for a higher price. But for them, farming is more than a business. It's a way of life. So even though their economic losses mount, they go deeper into debt, mortgaging their land for the cash to keep farming.
Not very long ago, Chuck had to go and borrow money to pay the interest on the borrowed money. And I know he looked at the banker and said, you begin to wonder, are we the only ones that are going through this? And the banker just laughed. And he said, there are many, many, many.
As long as land values rose, farmers survived. But land prices are falling now, and credit is drying up. Every week, more than 100 Minnesota family farms must sell out or face foreclosure. The Cantons know they are living on borrowed time. An auction is not easy for farmers to watch. In the past 30 years, they have said goodbye to more than half of their neighbors. But not since the Great Depression have so many auctions come so often. So many lives been changed forever. So many dreams died so suddenly.
All in all, that's fair. What do you know? Remember 53? 54? Sold the tractor $15,200. Number 110 by.
It's just so wrong, I think, for this nation that expects all the abundance and all the good things in the supermarkets and in the stores. And yet that the people who are here and doing it and working the 12, the 14, maybe 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, can't make it. Responsibility to challenge the pharaohs.
I got better than you. Tom says that we could get all this business settled real quick if we get 5,000 women armed with a rolling pin and sent them to Washington, D.C.
In 1977, Anne and a small group of farm women heard about a new farm organization, the American Agriculture Movement.
The whole thrust and idea was that we can do something about it ourselves. And it's at the point where we have to do something, that we can no longer rely on the experts. If we want to survive on this land, it's up to the people of the land to do it.
They began to organize meetings, small at first, but larger as farmers heard that others were demanding a fair price and a living wage.
It just got more exciting, and we got to the point where we were organized enough to put together a march on the Capitol in St. Paul. Because I never protested bodily, ever, to say that I, as a farmer, was protesting. It was scary for me, but it was also terribly exciting. And the next step then was to say something nationally. We arrived at Washington early in the morning, found our way to Capitol Hill, finally found a place to park, walked for blocks, came around the corner of the capital of the United States and saw 40,000 farmers. I cried. Couldn't believe it. I remember how good that was for Chuck. Because he grabbed me and he said, "We aren't the only ones."
I've been talking to them congressmen, I thought you know. I've been talking to them senators, way down that road. Said, "I'm tired of all your lies, bribes, and
a year later, in January 1979, they were back, this time with their tractors. They demanded federal policies that would guarantee a fair price for farm products and the survival of the family farm.
We found out that we could walk into senators' offices and congressmen's offices and we could talk to them. We knew what the issues were, and we could say it straight and strong, and hopefully get them to understand. And of course, they didn't understand. But Moses had to go many times. It was the 10th time that Pharaoh finally agreed. And he said, "Go, take your people."
Yes.
Yeah, I'm very struck early in that documentary with your use of a woman as the narrative voice. I'm so used to hearing in television and documentaries a deep male voice which the culture has identified with the voice of authority. And here you use a woman, it's a fairly deep woman's voice. What I hear is both a sense of authority but also a sense of compassion in her voice. It's very difficult, I would think, to try to find the right tone there if you become a dynamic choice.
Well, it's a good question. When I look back at the documentaries I've done, and then their narrations, I did that one time. Turns out it's right about 50-50. And I'm not sure, I don't remember exactly what we were thinking in 1983 about this specific decision, but in a way it's a little unusual because there have been some situations where if the main character is male, I'll often have a female as the narrative, as sort of a balance. One was somewhat unusual because all three characters in the program are women, and the narrator is a woman. And actually, the Ruth Young Doyle Nelson film had a female narrator also, and so will the next clip that you'll see. But I really try to find the person I think is kind of the right voice for the program, and I try to balance it. And I don't want a voice of God type narrator at all. I want the narrator to be a little bit in the background, have you be sympathetic and hear what they're saying, especially as a way to give you some of the facts so that the stories can be told by the people themselves. But
and here increasingly that voice drops out. I mean, it's almost just directly the voices of the characters.
And that's what we want to do, but I don't want to do everything that way, because often I feel like you can move the program along a little bit more if just some of the facts that anybody could state, and which we have to carefully check for PBS, and we have to, anything the narrator says, we have to be able to prove is indeed fact. What individuals say is seen as their opinion, and that's some of the different stories.
Is there another?
Well, I was just going to say, I know Ann Canton well, and I think it was the only choice because the genuineness of the person in that situation, you know, comes through so wonderfully. But I'm sure you're right. You have to check all the facts. Just wonderful.
And you know Ann, great.
I do.
Yes.
I was just going to say and comment to what the gentleman had to say. I think that now, and maybe 10 years ago also, that to have a woman portray what you're portraying, people set up and took a little more notice than the big gruff male, because of the male was portrayed, is portrayed a lot of times as this authority figure, and maybe this is just because I'm a woman, I'm feeling this, but it makes me as a woman think, hey, those guys don't have to do everything. You know, I'm not the little submissive, weak woman of 50 years ago. And we can also make changes. Right. We can also demand rights and this type of thing. And the world listens a lot better now. And I think sometimes in these cases, the world listens even better because it's a woman.
That may be.
Mm-hmm. And further to that, I really admired something that was very subtle in the film where she called herself the farmer. She didn't say the farmer's wife. And that's very subtle but very powerful, and something we're sort of assuming will happen now. But it's still a very powerful statement in and of itself, I think.
Well, and that's Anne, you know. It was simply true at that time that the key leadership was female. I mean, I thought the strongest, as we looked around for people, that was the case. And sometimes these things are not so totally conscious on my part. It's just that I'm really looking for who is the right person, male or female, to in a situation to express it.
Well,
yeah.
I just want to... What's nice there, you film in the kitchen before dawn where she talks on the walkie-talkie to her husband on the tractor, and when she gets to the point where she said, I was really glad because it was good for him to see, you know, the utter partnership there is really quite touching. And if anybody was going to be scared by the feminist angle that they might see, that's completely obliterated.
I don't gather that anyone did. Well, the next clip I'm going to show you is, I don't know how many people have either read the novel or seen the movie Snow Falling on Cedars.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a few, okay. Well, this is the story, this particular documentary, which is called Visible Target, is the real story on which Snow Falling on Cedars is based. And actually, this film was used in the Classroom by David Buderson, who wrote Snow Falling on Cedars. But the real story is based on an event that occurred not on this fictional island that is portrayed in the book and the film, but a real island called Bainbridge Island near Seattle, Washington. And it was the first place from which Japanese Americans were taken from their homes and sent to internment camps during World War II. And it was an island that was torn apart by different sentiment over whether this was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. But among the Caucasians on the island, the strongest spokespeople against what was happening, and in fact the only newspaper on the west coast of the United States at the time that strongly editorialized against this and said it was the wrong thing to do, was a little newspaper called the Bainbridge Review. And the editor, Walt Woodward, and his wife, Millie Woodward, who published the paper together, took this stand for which they received both support from some people and a lot of antagonism from other people. Walt Woodward in the film is the character of Walt Woodward is actually the Sam Shepard character, the father of the kid, because the event in Snow Falling on Cedars takes place in the earlier mid-50s, some years after the war is over. But it's based on this story. David Guterson himself was a high school teacher in Bainbridge Island. So I'm going to show you just a little bit about what happened. We'll start with Pearl Harbor and see a little bit of what happened on Bainbridge Island at that time.
The U.S. was at war, and on Bainbridge Island, 300 people looked like the enemy.
I wasn't particularly scared or anything. Japan's way over there, America's way over here, and we're American citizens.
It didn't matter. The U.S. fleet was crippled at Pearl Harbor, and the West Coast, with its numerous military installations, prepared for the worst.
We came very close to going under as a nation. We were really fighting for our existence.
On Bainbridge Island, strategically located between a naval shipyard and defense industries, people feared they were next in line for attack. They looked suspiciously at the Japanese in their midst.
It was utter confusion because no one knew anything really, truly. And rumors were flying all over. There were submarines off the coast.
There were rumors that there were known to be hidden radios and transmitting messages out.
There were rumors that Japanese spies had been apprehended.
They claimed that they arrested some Japanese people that were taking pictures up above the Navy Yard over there.
Japanese immigrants first came to Bainbridge Island in the 1880s. They worked hard, saved their money, and by World War II, most had acquired small strawberry farms. Like other Asians, they were prohibited from citizenship, but their American-born children were United States citizens by birth. On Bainbridge, Omotos grew up with Johnsons. Nakatas lived beside Joneses.
I started in the first grade with 19 Japanese children and 12 Caucasians, and they were always the smartest, the dearest, and the nicest kids in the class.
Yet there was little other mixing of the races. The Japanese were excluded from the American melting pot. Asian Americans had endured years of racial and legal discrimination.
I still felt like I was a second-class citizen because we were denied so many things. We could not work, for instance, at the Navy Yard or Boeing or join some of the unions. Have you ever watched a well-trained monkey at a zoo? Have you seen how carefully he imitates his trainer? The monkey goes through so many human movements so well that he actually seems to be human. But under his fur, he's still a savage little beast. Now, consider the imitative little Japanese.
War hysteria. Japanese victories in the Pacific bring nightmares of invasion. Bainbridge boys begin dying on distant battlefields. National leaders and much of the popular media fail to distinguish between the enemy and Americans of Japanese ancestry. Responding, Japanese Americans tried desperately to demonstrate their loyalty.
We disposed of everything that was Japanese, magazines and books, records. What we could burn, we burned. And what we could bury, we buried.
It didn't matter. At first, radical white supremacy groups, and eventually, almost everyone on the West Coast, demanded the removal of all Japanese from coastal areas. But Walt and Millie Woodward felt differently. They were publishers of a weekly newspaper, the Bainbridge Review. The night after Pearl Harbor, they stayed up late to print an extra edition. They asked their readers to remember that the island Japanese had nothing to do with the bombing.
The aim was to prevent hysteria, panic.
But the FBI rounds up hundreds of Japanese-born people suspected of loyalty to their mother country. Agents raid Bainbridge Island homes.
They saw my father go to the corner and pray. And he said, "This is my country. This is my adopted country. I haven't done anything wrong, and God knows that."
Those arrested are not charged with any crime, but are sent to detention camps anyway. Dynamite for blasting stumps, shotguns for shooting crows. The agents take them too, plus cameras and radios. These could be used to help the enemy, they say.
Okay, who's hacking the wall then?
Hisa Matsudaira was younger than the children she now teaches when the agents came and her mother told her her father had been taken away to prison.
I remembered the dress she had on and she was crying. And that was the first time I ever saw my mother cry. And then I knew were prisons that I knew were criminal prisons. And I couldn't figure out why they had taken Bob and put him in prison.
Even the FBI roundup failed to quiet West Coast demands for removal. Several government investigations had confirmed the overwhelming loyalty of Japanese Americans, but Army officers believed that an espionage net, including Japanese Americans, was already active. President Roosevelt was urged to remove all persons of Japanese ancestry from coastal areas. The president, supported by Congress, complied. Virtually the entire West Coast press supported the action, but not the Woodwards.
Anybody who has ever bothered to read the Bill of Rights knows that that's a clear violation of that Bill of Rights. There was no court order, no warrants issued.
Bainbridge Japanese Americans were the first uprooted by the Army. On March 23rd, signs went up on the island ordering the evacuation of all Japanese, aliens and citizens alike, within a week. The government made no arrangements to protect their farms and businesses. Walt and Millie Woodward were angry. Week after week, they had advocated tolerance and justice for island Japanese American citizens. But theirs was a lonely voice.
We were accused at times of being Jap lovers. There were many people that felt sympathetic towards our position, but very few of them came up out front and became a visible target like we did.
Review editorials drew fire from readers, and the paper lost advertising and subscriptions. But the Woodwards stood firm.
if it could happen to Japanese Americans, it can happen to Scottish Americans or Italian Americans or Rotary Club Americans or fat Americans or skinny Americans.
Follows what happened to the people and shows that even though the courage of these newspaper editors and the stand that they took certainly wasn't able to prevent those people from being taken away, it was able to change sentiment on Bainbridge Island to the degree that the losses of land and property and other things on the island that Japanese Americans suffered were very, very small compared to what was the case on the rest of the West Coast, and they returned to a welcome there, which was not true also elsewhere on the West Coast, so this did make a difference.
So their neighbors took care of their land for them while they were gone?
A lot of them did, yeah. And of course that was true up and down the coast, but in many cases people found legal ways to actually steal the land while they were gone. And that happened, there were a couple of incidents of that also on Bainbridge, but it was far less common than was true throughout the West Coast.
Mm-hmm. Did the FBI do anything to the Woodwards or try to silence them or to threat them?
That's a good question. I don't think they really did. I think that, it's hard to say. I'm sure they kept tabs on them, but there was nothing overt that was done. Yes,
it just seems that the Woodwards become an example of doing through the media what you want to do in your documentary.
Well, that's true in a way. I mean, I haven't really thought about it, but that's really true in a way. I'll show two more quick clips from the same documentary and from a different. Both from the same documentary, but a different documentary called It's Up to Us. And this is about, the documentary is actually about a group called the Giraffe Project. Some of you may have heard of them. They're based on Whidbey Island, Washington, and they honor people all around the country who, quote, stick their necks out for the common good. So when I found out about them, it seemed like what they were doing very much dovetailed with my interest. And so I did a program for PBS on the organization as a whole. And within that show, we look at about seven different individuals who have been honored as giraffes and their stories. And I'll show you two of those stories. They're each about 3 minutes long. The first one is the story of the real Patch Adams. I don't know if any of you have seen the Hollywood movie or heard about it starring Robin Williams. Well, this is the real guy. And the real story, you'll notice that he certainly doesn't look anything like Robin Williams. I enjoyed the film itself, but it's quite different from the real Patch Adams. So I'll show you that first, and then the last profile is a look at a Catholic priest named Bill Wasmuth, who stood up against the Aryan Nations in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, when they were... there were a series of terrible racist campaigns going on in northern Idaho in the late 1980s. So, first the story of Patch Adams.
Though aren't seeking advice, they're sharing stories about people like Patch Adams.
Emergency! Take one of these and swallow it at least three times a day. If you have trouble swallowing it, just put it in your mouth like this. And you'll feel a lot better.
Laughter is the best medicine, he says. Dr. Patch Adams is a respected physician who believes America's medical system needs radical surgery.
Medicine has become a business, and a very big business. No longer is it perceived as a service-oriented part of the community, but a part of the community where a person can make a lot of money.
Not so for Patch. and several associates offered free medical care to anyone in need.
We used our home for 12 years. We, the staff, worked irregular part-time jobs to pay to help other people.
Financially, their combination home and hospital was a shaky operation.
We have over 1,000 foundation rejections. We have never been able to even remotely interest a state, county, or federal government in any of our work.
As word about their work spread, people everywhere responded.
Every single state sends us money. We get $1 checks. We get boxes of used sheets from people saying, I know you'll need some sheets.
Today, Patch Adams and his friends have taken temporary leave of medical practice. Here in the hills of West Virginia, they're building a dream. A free hospital where doctors and patients will live and work together in a healing community. Patch calls it the Gesundheit Institute.
So we chose the name Gesundheit because it makes people laugh. There's an atmosphere thing that we're trying to create that is happy, funny, loving, cooperative, and creative. And of all of those things, if you don't have humor around human suffering, it will burn you out.
Yes, sirs and madams, I'm Dr. Niedermann, and I'm the genuine representative of Not Quite the Answer Products.
Patch also believes doctors ought to be as concerned about preventing illness as they are about treating it. Using humor, he teaches people about healthy living. He calls it his traveling medicine show, and he plays to appreciative crowds all across the country.
You walk on over to your teeth, and you brush up, holding the brush at a 45-degree angle between the teeth and the gum line.
Patch Adams is sticking his neck out to improve our healthcare system, and the medical profession is paying attention.
Medical students, nurses, they hear about our work, and they're overwhelmingly supportive. We represent the dream for people. Greed has infected our society. It is the worst infection. And we are a pie in the face of greed. We are taking the most expensive thing in America and giving it away for free.
Getting the word out about people like Patch.
I'm just going to scan this. This is up ahead to the next segment, which it'll probably take about a minute to queue up to the next segment that I'm going to show.
How long ago did he start the hospital then?
Well, this was in 1988, I don't know when it was actually came together.
Is it operating today?
Yes, it is.
What town is it in West Virginia?
You know, I don't remember that either, because in the making of the film, that part of the footage was the only part of which we got from another source. We didn't go to the place where they were doing that. So I don't know specifically the answer to that.
To expenses. Olga lives on a pension.
This is my body, which will be given up for you.
Father Bill Wasmuth lives in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. It's a Western resort town, small, friendly, and traditional. But a few years ago, the peace and quiet here was shattered. They came to Northern Idaho calling for an all-white nation in the Pacific Northwest. The Aryan Nations, a racist organization, made Coeur d'Alene its headquarters.
Initially, the community reaction was to just let them be, live and let live, that kind of a philosophy. But then we found out very quickly that such inaction was interpreted by both the Aryans and by the rest of the country as being tacit support, if not active support.
When When Aryans began harassing minorities in Coeur d'Alene, concerned citizens formed a task force to defend human rights. As leader of the task force, Father Bill became a symbol of resistance to racism.
I thought that we wouldn't be safe because the Aryans would figure out that if they attacked any of us at all, that it would just galvanize the community against them. Unfortunately, we gave them too much credit for thinking.
In 1986, a series of bombings rocked the town of Coeur d'Alene. The first bomb went off here in Bill Wasmuth's house. If he'd been in his kitchen instead of his living room, it might have killed him.
I will consider KRU well.
Bill was afraid, but he refused to back down.
I stayed in my house that night. I stayed in my house the next night and never left. The community was watching very much on how I responded to this thing, and if I responded in a great deal of fear, they would end up with a lot of fear and panic as well. I didn't want that to happen.
It didn't happen. The citizens of Coeur d'Alene rallied around Father Bill and the task force, leaving the Aryans alone and defeated.
People really are. Their hearts are in the right place on this issue. Some have had to look deeply within themselves because of the presence of the Aryans and make a choice and they can get off the fence. They've done that. The community is very anxious to be a model community in terms of openness to all peoples of all races, creeds, and colors. Make a difference in your world.
So that's what I have to show today. And any other questions? Or
Feel free to turn this question around to like say something more useful if that's not a helpful question. But I'm curious, in a collaborative medium like this that involves, you know, lots of people come together to create a project like this, everything from, you know, fundraising to sound technicians to all kinds of folks. Do you have any comments to make about a shared vision being necessary or not surrounding that kind of collaboration? Do the people, the many different people who work on such a project, need to be share some kind of commitment to? Anyway, I'll let you take it.
Oh, well, that's a good question. It's a lot less of a problem in these kind of things than it would be in, say, a major Hollywood production, because we work with very small companies. So in this particular case, I will go out normally with a crew of three. It's myself, a camera person, and a sound person. Sometimes there's a fourth person, associate producer, or another producer. For instance, the Bainbridge Island one I produced with another producer. That was also true of the Ann Canton thing. Starting working with camera and sound people we go over what it's about, they share the vision to a degree at least, and they also, you know, want to do a good job. I do the writing and editing as well. So in documentary, often you'll find that the producer is not just in a Hollywood film. You see producers, it's normally just the person who sort of raises the money and finds the creative people who do things. And then there's a director who directs the actors, and it's all kinds of different split up jobs. But in documentary, often the person who's called producer is also the director, frequently the writer, sometimes the editor, sometimes, though not in my case, sometimes even does the camera work, but I never do camera. So it's a fairly small group, and usually we're all on the same page on these stories.
Mm-hmm. I think, kind of along with her question and your answer also, that you the people that are actually wind up working on it wouldn't be there if they weren't somewhat on the same page, weren't empathetic, weren't, you know, interested in showing what is happening and that type of thing. I don't think that they would apply for the job or be there in the first place.
Well, it's that's generally true, although you occasionally get technicians who as she points out, don't really have a lot of interest in it, but they certainly have an interest in doing a good job, and they don't, you know, they often do technical skills that aren't requiring that much creative input. Now, if it's the camera person, that's a different thing. They really, really have to be, I think, on the same page with the producer director to get the feeling and the flavor that you want.
Can I ask about money? She mentioned that, but how is it hard to raise money for these kinds of films, or is it easy, or no, what do you do?
It's terribly difficult, as you can imagine. I mean, there just isn't a lot of funding. I mean, I've almost never got any corporate funding. I actually did get a little corporate funding for this last film that you saw about the giraffe project, but most of my funding comes from foundations, and they're receiving, of course, tons and tons of worthy applications all the time for limited pools of money. So it's difficult. It was, in some ways, a little easier when I first started in TV because there was actually more public money. That kind of went downhill real fast with the Reagan administration. It's come back somewhat in the 90s, but certainly not to the levels comparatively that we were seeing in the late 70s when I got my start in television. So it's hard to fund things, and they're not likely to have great commercial value for investors or that sort of thing, and they sell limited numbers of copies to schools and libraries, but not much. Affluenza has been my only film that's actually been what might be called a modestly big seller, popular film. But the others, that hasn't been the case. But anyway, they hopefully get. All of these programs were shown on national public television, so they got audiences from that, and then they've been used, I think, a lot in colleges, schools, and particularly in churches. The programs have been very popular in churches.
John, what are you showing this week? Do you know the schedule of showings?
Tomorrow I'm looking at the environment and doing some stuff about, it's called Stewards of Creation, about people who have worked, and stories of people who have worked to save the environment, including the story of the people who fought to create North Cascades National Park in this area way back at the time when the Holden Mine was just closing down. The third session is called Empowering the Poor, and in that it's stories of economic justice, poor people fighting for their rights, both here in the United States and in Latin America. And one of the stories is about a community organization, Hispanic community organization in San Antonio, Texas, and how its efforts really changed that city. The fourth one is about, is kind of the affluenza thing, and it's about voluntary simplicity, the voluntary simplicity movement, and it's about living simply so others can simply live, I think I call it. And then the last one, Think Globally, Act Locally, is really about local organic food production, and it's a story, and I'm going to show one film all the way through there, and my latest, which is called Beyond Organic. It's a story of a small farm in Santa Barbara, California, that folks fought for 20 years against encroaching development in some of the highest priced real estate in the country to keep this farm going, and finally succeeded, and it's become a model for people around the country and around the world. And Meryl Streep actually narrated that one. So anyway,
are you showing affluenza?
And then that's different. These are the sessions, but then they're also showing films, which I think tomorrow evening I'm going to do a couple of short films, one I made and one I didn't, about that are about Latin America. And then we're going to show a film which I didn't make but had a kind of a consulting role on, about global warming and the fate of Pacific Islanders, who are really the canaries in the coal mine of global warming, and what's already happening to them that the rest of the world isn't seeing. Then we're going to show. Affluenza is showing on Friday afternoon, and then on Friday evening, a program called For Earth's Sake, The Life and Times of David Brower. David Brower is the famous environmentalist who built the Sierra Club and founded Friends of the Earth from the Earth Island Institute and led the fight for the North Cascades National Park. And the other film I'm showing is called Full Circle, and that's a documentary about the story of Native Americans in Washington State. I did that one for the Washington State Centennial. And so if you're interested in the stories of Indian people in this state, that's what Full Circle's about.
Thank you. Thank you.